Today on Wings. In September 2020, under cover of the COVID lockdown, India's parliament passed three bills to radically change the country's farm system. Farmers have defied the lockdown to mount a massive ongoing protest against laws the government claims will modernize the farming sector, but farmers say will devastate their livelihoods.
I always smile at the COVID, you know, the little virus. I say so many racketeers hid behind you, COVID, to do things they could not do when democracy was vibrant. But the beauty of the protest today is, in spite of the lockdown, millions of farmers have shown how a vibrant democracy can look.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Dr. Vandana Shiva is both an activist and an expert on farm policies and practices, a researcher on sustainable agriculture, an author of a major farm bill, and a leading defender of farmers' rights. She spoke in depth about the present and past of colonial and corporate efforts to control India's farmlands in a series of Zoom interviews with Aditi Meyer. Meyer is a South Asian American journalist whose work explores the intersections of sustainability and social politics, and she's a Women's Media Foundation fellow.
It would be remiss of me not to acknowledge what is currently happening in India with the farmer protests, which is now being called the largest organized strike in the history of the world, with over 250 million participants. And so farmers across India are protesting three agricultural bills. These bills promise liberalizations, but in reality, farmers will face the privatization of the agricultural sphere. Dr. Shiva, as someone who has been an ardent supporter of small farmers as the key to sustainability and biodiversity, and you've been a champion against the corporatization of this sphere and corporate monopoly, what are your thoughts on the current situation and where do we go from here?
So the current acts, one is dismantling of the Essential Commodities Act, which means totally deregulated prices and a recipe for famine. The second is dismantling the regional system where states decided, and there were cooperatives of farmers and small traders, and there was a stock limit that goes and the big giants can buy. But the current protests are against the third law. The third is the contract law.
This Contracts Act allows so-called sponsors to contractually bind farmers to a firm price on a crop that has not yet been planted, and to impose strict conditions as to exactly how the farming is to be done. This is similar to corporate farming practices that have overtaken independent farms across the United States. India's Contracts Act invalidates all state farming regulations and does not require payment until after delivery of a fully acceptable product.
The farmers are totally rightfully rejecting these laws, and they keep saying that farmers are afraid. Farmers are afraid. No, farmers have experienced since 1991 the corporate hijack of their share of what the consumer pays. Now, farmers know if this system of deregulated commerce is pushed and no regulation is there, these prices are going to collapse and they won't be able to survive. And they also know with globalization, the price the consumer pays goes up. They're fighting for survival. And I'm totally behind them because this, I say, is a fight for the soul of India. It is a fight for the civilization and its values that has consciously stayed agrarian in spite of repeated attempts to dismantle our agrarian soul and leave us both desertified in terms of the soil and desertified in terms of our soul. So we are in a very, very critical juncture. And I've seen too many tricks played over these decades of work I've been doing. And I just hope all the strength stays with the farmers who have shown their strength so long. And they continue to say it's either yes to our demand of repeal the laws or a no, in which case we will not go home till you repeal the laws.
You're listening to Dr. Vandana Shiva, talking with Aditi Meyer on Zoom. One thing Dr. Shiva did not specify in these segments is who exactly pushed for the new farm laws. Mariah Gillardin of TUC Radio searched out those facts.
Stock market advisors are asking, who benefits from the farm bills? Specifically, it seems, the mega corporations owned by Mukesh Ambani and Gautam Adani, who happen to have funded the $5 billion political campaign which won BJP Narendra Modi the Prime Minister's office. Also, during the COVID lockdowns, Facebook Mark Zuckerberg invested $5.7 billion and Google Alphabet Inc. invested $4.5 billion for an equity stake in Ambani's mega corporation, Jio. This Facebook, Google, and Ambani alliance is set to capture India's internet boom and force transition to a digital economy. In this business plan, WhatsApp is slated to become the purchase point of food distribution in India, eliminating small businesses, local vendors, neighborhood corner shops, and farmers' markets.
Currently, India has a variety of local digital apps that are used to connect some farmers and buyers, but powerful corporate apps like WhatsApp tend to sweep competitors aside. Some media laud the farm bills as promising new markets and profits for small farmers, but Dr. Shiva points to a history of false promises that the farmers know well. Interviewer Aditi Meyer.
A critical juncture in India's agriculture sector was the Green Revolution in the 1960s and 1970s. So, Dr. Shiva, for those that are not familiar, can you give a brief overview of what the Green Revolution was, for its benign name, and what its impacts were that were not so green?
So, you know, there was no green politics at that time. The word green did not mean ecology. Green was just a different color from red. And the Americans were very scared of red. So they just wanted a different name. The Green Revolution was not green. It was not revolutionary. It was basically an attempt being made ever since the wars ended to take war chemicals. The chemical fertilizers were basically made in the same labs and same factories in which explosives were made, the same IG Farben. Made nitrogen fertilizers and made explosives, and the same process. All of the pesticides are derivatives of Xylon B and poison gases that were made again for Hitler's concentration camps and for the wars. So after the wars were ended, instead of just folding up and saying we'll shut these factories, they had got so addicted to making huge money. And Rachel Carson has written about it in her book, Silent Spring. Albert Howard has written about it in his book, An Agricultural Testament, that those who had got addicted to making money out of selling chemicals continued to sell them now as agrichemicals. So the big issue was they wanted to sell fertilizers and chemicals. The problem was when chemicals were applied to our native varieties of seeds, which were tall, because they were dual purpose, the straw gave food for the animals and the grain gave food for us. So we created dual purpose animals, milk from the cows and animal energy from the bullocks and dual purpose crops to feed the animals, including human animals. But when you apply chemicals to these tall crops, they lodge if there's wind or too much rain. And this problem of lodging was the big problem. So they kept trying Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, and then Norman Borlaug, who worked for DuPont Defense Lab, was put on the job of changing the plant to adapt to the chemicals rather than adapt the farming techniques to the native seeds. And that's why he created the dwarf varieties. And these dwarf varieties were misleadingly called high-yielding varieties. How can less be more? You know? And when I did my Green Revolution book, my eyes would tell me, here's a lie, but my science will tell me, bigger lie. These were not high-yielding variety. They were high chemical demanding varieties, high response varieties, but they needed 10 times more water to grow the same amount of food. And that's the root of the water crisis of Punjab, for which the farmers are being blamed. But it was imposed on them. There were conditionalities put. If you couldn't ensure you had taken chemicals, you couldn't take a loan to send your daughter to college. Credit conditionalities on the farmer, and on India, credit conditionalities from the World Bank. All of this also meant these short varieties came with mechanization, and just the top of the grain was picked up by the harvester, and the stubble was left, and they told the farmer, burn the stubble. And now they told the farmer, use your water, use the chemicals. They told the farmer, burn the stubble, and now they want to fine farmers 20 million rupees each for doing what they were told to do. So one of the demands of the farmers right now is this should not be criminalized. So the Green Revolution, what did it end up doing? And it was prescribed by the World Bank. It was conditionality. 65, we had a drought. The prices of wheat went up slightly. And those days we used to, under rupee payment, import a little extra wheat from US. It was called the PL 40. And Lal Bahadur Shastri asked for a little more wheat to stabilize prices. No one was dying of hunger and famine. There was no famine in India in 65. I was in school and I remember. Prices rose up. Sugar was a problem. And the US said, sorry, we won't send you wheat unless you change your agriculture and use chemicals. And Shastri said, I will not experiment with such a large agrarian population. We can do it on a small scale, and if it works, we'll adopt it. And then the pressure continued and the Green Revolution was imposed. By 91, we had structural adjustment because the debt of the Green Revolution for dams, for irrigation, for chemicals, for the whole system. 30% of the debt of 91, the 90 billion debt, was caused by the Green Revolution. And that then started to push new reforms, they call it, yeah, which is basically create a crisis, use it as an opportunity to expand your control and your market. The difference between the 91 Green Revolution, when the big corporations were the Cargills for grain and the Monsantos, the difference is today we have our own giants who all have partnership with global giants. They don't work alone. I mean, suddenly out of the blue, a Reliance cannot become a digital company without the help of Microsoft and Gates. They cannot become a grain company, or Adani can't become a grain company overnight. So they're becoming the front, just like when Monsanto entered the Green Revolution. They entered behind Mahiko. They always find an Indian partner to hide behind.
At first, the farmers were pushed to specialize in mass production of wheat and rice. Up until the passage of the 2020 farm bills, these grains were distributed through the national and state governments. That distribution, as mentioned, is now to be privatized. In 2002, another mass crop was pushed upon the farmers. That year, Monsanto introduced genetically modified cotton into India. Known as BT cotton, this patented plant incorporates strains of a bacterium, Bacillus thuringiensis, that causes the plant to manufacture its own pesticide. Billed as requiring less chemical pesticide application, over time BT cotton has come to require even more pesticide than other strains of cotton, as pests that are resistant to BT are on the rise. Large numbers of farmers who took out loans for patented, non-self-reproducing seeds and the amenities they require have fallen into unpayable debts. Many desperate farmers have committed suicide using pesticides. Vandana Shiva.
And I want to show you just two images. So in 2000, I did a public hearing on farmer suicides. This was in Bangalore. This is a Sikh farmer who had come, whose brother has committed suicide because of debt. And that's not all. In 2006, this is still in my heart. I still carry this pain. You know, usually in Punjab, everyone's with a colorful turban. All the women are in colorful chunnis. This is all white. 2,000 widows in a gurdwara in Bhatinda, giving evidence to us. We were on a jury, a public jury of a public trial, 2,000 widows. And all of them said, and then he took the spray, as a spray, kehte hain, you know, in Punjabi, a spray, yeah? The poison spray They took spray that got them into debt for the BT cotton. They were all BT cotton farmers. Vidarbha suicides, Bhatinda suicides, all connected through the poison cartel. And what we are seeing on the streets of Delhi or all over the country today with the Bharat Bandh is a continuation of this exploitation. And to me, this is genocide. I've said it, I've been trolled by the Monsantos of the world. But when you deliberately harm a community, and farmers are a community, and you cause harm to the extent that 400,000 of them have to commit suicide, this is genocide and it has to stop. And I hope your networks will play their role to create another economy through a new solidarity.
Thank you, Dr. Shiva.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from Aditi Meyer's interviews with Dr. Vandana Shiva. Meyer's website, addimay.com, is about decolonizing fashion.
I want to take a step back and rewind a bit. And I want to talk about the beginnings of this shift where we had colonization. And in 1664, the East India Company was created. And one of the major goals was to subdue India's textile economy. And so there was a plan, a systemic plan created to subdue the Indian farmer and make the switch from subsistence farming to cotton crop. And this was a very pivotal point. Not only would this eventually subject farmers to a cycle of interest-laden debt, it would also diminish the food supply. India was to constantly supply the British mills with cotton, being only the exporter of raw material, only to be sold that cotton back at a premium, which left our own spinners and weavers unable to afford that cotton. Britain became this workshop of the world, and especially during the 19th century, the US and British cotton relationship, which was predicated on the use of slave labor in America, also further diminished India's textile economy. So with that framing in mind, Dr. Shiva, you have said that the rupture of oneness with the earth was a very deep construct and impact of colonialism. So we know this to be true when it comes to the modes of agriculture and how our relationship with land and labor is so predicated on output, output, output. So I'd love to know, how do you think colonialism has affected our modern day understanding of both land and labor?
The East India Company, as the name tells you, was created to conquer India because India at that time was 25% of the world economy. We were the world economy and we were the traders of the world for spices and textiles. And given that your platform is a fashion platform, for me, the poorest woman in the poorest village was walking fashion, you know, because we'd managed after independence to bring textiles back. How did colonialism change land and labor? We never believed in property in land. This is Sabhi Bhumi Gopal ki dharti ma. Even now at the farmers' protest, they keep talking about the soil as their mother, and what they're fighting for is their bond with her. So the British colonialism was a mega, mega, mega land grab. Not just in India. You know, the peasant lands were taken and became colonial lands. And then the British appointed zamindars. And the brilliant, and this is something you should look at. We have two volumes of the ecological history of food and farming. Because in the Northwest provinces, as it was called, the farmers' protest started immediately with this extraction of lagan, the rent. And I have links to Sir Chotu Ram, who's the governor at that time of the Northwestern provinces. But the farmers protesting today were farmers who fought against the British zamindari and stayed owner cultivators. They were never working for landlords or were never landlords hiring other labor. But the East India was turned to zamindari, was pushed to famines. Then the Land Alienation Act of Northwestern Provinces kept the Punjab farmer a proud, independent farmer, which is why they've risen again and again and again. But $45 trillion was transferred by the British. They made land their property and collected rents called lagan. Where did the lagan come from? From the farmers. What was this $45 trillion of wealth transferred to England? The creativity, productivity of the land, and the creativity and productivity of the farmer. $45 trillion of this wealth was transferred by the colonial system. And the peasants who created that wealth were pushed to famine, 60 million famine deaths during the British period. Of course, they then created the fabric of theorizing what science is Bacon, what property is Locke, what politics is Hobbes. I mean, I want to do a bonfire of these big white men's lies, because they brainwashed so many generations of people. And Adam Smith writes this book on the wealth of nations, which is really about the theft from nations. And he talks about it being in our DNA to be greedy and take away from others. No, it's in our DNA to protect the earth, share. Look at the langurs on the streets where the farmers are protesting, the giving of food. This is not about grabbing, it's about giving. So how was land changed? It was turned into property, but of the colonizer, and the original custodians, they were left destitute. But land was also turned into an inert dead matter, and all the theorizing of the Bacons of that time was the earth is dead matter. And my life's work for the last so many decades, 50 years now, has been to show how capitalist patriarchy totally redefined our relationships with the earth and our perception of ourselves. Our bodies were also turned into inert raw material. And our only work was as slaves. And the narrative that was built, it was the mills of Lancashire and Manchester that created the wealth of England. No, they were colonizing 200 years before those mills came. And their empire was an empire of cotton, for which they grabbed all of the land of the indigenous people of the Americas, turned it into cotton plantations. But because it was so much, they then had to capture Africans and slaves. And do tell the Black Lives Matter movement that it is time to create a global unity against colonialism. It is not just a problem of one group of people on one piece of land. It's a global problem. And we are connected through cotton being turned from the thread of prosperity to a thread of slavery. In terms of labor, this, I think, is the big deconstruction that has to be done, the decolonization of work. So much has been written about alienation of labor, about extraction of surplus value, the entire edifice of inequality, exploitation, extraction, both from the earth and from people. And sadly, because we've inherited those definitions as if they are Bibles written by Christ himself or Moses, Ten Commandments, people still think within those categories. So people are taking it as inevitable. Even though Gandhi totally challenged the idea of industrialization with the spinning wheel, people are taking it as inevitable that artificial intelligence and robotics is going to destroy all work and 99% humanity will be useless. Now is the time for the spinning wheel in every hand, the seed in every hand. Decolonization means the colonizer's agenda must be challenged with another imagination.
Vandana Shiva's organization Navdanya is a crucible for ideas like ecofeminism. Their 2021 online book, Women, Nature, and Agriculture, begins with the statement, "Most farmers in India are women." Quote, "Agriculture employs 70% of the working population and about 84% of all economically active women." It goes on to say that many more women who farm are not counted as workers because their work falls outside the so-called production boundary, which delineates the cash exchange economy. Attempts to mollify resistance to the new farm bills include claims that only the rich farmers are against the bill and that it will help poor farmers. Rich farmers can be read as a code for the Sikhs in Punjab, who fought off British colonial seizures of their lands and also protested the Green Revolution. Religious prejudice is an ideal tool for dividing and conquering. The ruling BJP is experienced at sowing religious conflict. And the British, when they gave up colonization of India in 1947, created chaos by creating two independent states, India for Hindus and Pakistan for Muslims. Sikhs, though neither Hindu nor Muslim, were assigned to the Hindu side.
The Sikhs moved this side, and the Muslims moved that side. The partition left only Sikh farmers. Earlier, there used to be a mixture. So the farmers of Punjab are Sikhs.
Vandana Shiva speaking with Aditi Meyer.
Now, Actually, Aditi, during British time, the Punjab farmers refused to become serfs and stayed owner-cultivators. By the time Green Revolution came, they said, we got to build on the best because this wasn't a destroyed agriculture. And then they started to destroy it. Here's the Green Revolution that says Punjab will grow grain for everyone else and it will only be rice and wheat. And rice is not a Punjab crop, but they were forced to grow rice. And now it should supply the whole country. And as a result of that, by 1984, the farmers of Punjab resisting, 84 was a peasant movement. The narrative was changed, but it was a farmers' movement. And the farmers were saying, and I have it written here, if the hard-earned income of the people or the natural resources of any nation or region are forcibly plundered, the goods produced by them are paid at arbitrarily determined prices, while the goods bought by them are sold at high prices. And in order to carry this process of economic exploitation to its logical conclusion, the human rights of people or of a nation are crushed, then these are indices of slavery of that nation, region, or people. Today, the six are shackled by chains of slavery. This type of slavery is thrust upon the states and 80% of India's population of poor people and minority.
In the uprising of 1984, Sikhs demanded the government give more autonomy to Punjab, and Prime Minister Indira Gandhi ordered an attack on the Sikhs' most sacred site, the Golden Temple. She was then assassinated by two Sikh bodyguards, and then the ruling party fomented an anti-Sikh pogrom. Thousands of Sikhs were murdered in 40 cities across India.
So the Green Revolution brought 84, and every narrative, if you look at it, 84 story is never told in terms of the farmers. 4th of June, the farmers of Punjab were going to blockade the supply of grain to Delhi. They had blockaded the governor's house. They were going to blockade the trains. 40% of the supply of food of India today, especially the public distribution system, is now grown by the farmers. Now, this grain had to be brought somewhere so the government could pick it up and supply it around the country. The current act is, in effect, trying to hand over the trade to the giant corporations.
Vandana Shiva explained the basis for the ongoing farmers' strike in India to journalist and video blogger Aditi Meyer. You can find the videos posted on YouTube. The channel name is Aditi Meyer. That's A-D-I-T-I-M-A-Y-E-R. Meyer's website, adimay.com, is about decolonizing fashion. That's A-D-I-M-A-Y.com. Thanks also to Mariah Gillardin of TUC Radio for sharing her content. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our website wingsradio.org/WordPress. Thank you to all Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose fortnightly salons, including one with Vandana Shiva, can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer, Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.